morning is Eliotto against the Town of Lisbon. Ms. Race, out of time for resting.
Good morning, Your Honors.
Good morning.
May it please the Court, Attorney Carrie Race appears on behalf of Plaintiff Appellant Gaetano Eliotto. I think there's two separate motions before the Court, or the issue of decisions of motion by Judge Stattmuller, including a motion for leave to amend, which was denied by the District Court, and motions to dismiss, which were granted. And I'd like to point out that the same standard at the basis of those motions permeates throughout, and that's the standard found in Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 8A, which is simply that a claimant must only present a short and plain statement of their claims showing that the pleader is entitled to relief.
Yeah, but look, Ms. Race, in adding claims such as the First Amendment right of association challenge in that amended complaint, didn't you essentially, forgive me, present a moving target to the defendants such that they would have to file a new motion to dismiss in order to, you know, address the added claims? So how could we, under such circumstances, say that it was an abuse of discretion for the court to prevent that type of conduct?
I would disagree that these are new claims. The original complaint, while inartfully pled, it was certainly designated numerous claims and presented a long litany of facts. I would point the court to this court's case, Ortiz.
I'm going to stop you.
Okay.
Because the original complaint did not appear, certainly, to contain any claim either based on Chapter 62 of the Wisconsin statutes, nor did it include anything that even resembled a right of association claim.
I would argue that it does, in that...
Will you tell me where, and I'll go back and I'll look at it again.
The Ortiz case, which, as I said, is of this court in 2009, plainly states that a claimant must not plead exact claims. They must only provide a factual basis on which a shortened plain statement.
Okay, so are you arguing now that there is or there is not a right of association claim?
In the original complaint? Or?
Uh-huh.
I would argue that it's there. I would argue that the factual basis...
So where is it? Because I don't want to spend, you know, like a week looking for it.
Let me pull out my original complaint. I mean, the facts that would support that are the same facts that were pled in the amended complaint, in that anybody that is associated with Sergeant Eliotto were subjected to the same retaliation and harassment that he was subjected to by Chief Moderano and the town. I don't want to spend my time. I understand the court's desire to pinpoint that.
Well, then, all right. You argue what you want to argue. That's okay. Go ahead.
Okay.
I
would just, getting beyond that, I think that the motion for leave to amend is fairly clear. The mandate of the Supreme Court in Foeman states that it is a mandate to be heeded that leave shall be given when good cause is shown in the interest of justice. I believe that there was good cause here, and good cause has been, in case law, has been associated with diligence, and I believe that the district court's recitation of the clear facts in this case support the idea that the plaintiff was diligent in amending the complaint. The record speaks for itself as to the progress of the case in the district court. It was filed. It was removed by the defendants to federal court and answered. A scheduling order was entered, and motions to dismiss were not filed until approximately 9 months later. The case did not proceed during that time. It was in the face of motions to dismiss by the defendants that plaintiff moved to amend, and I think that that's diligence. I mean, it's hard. I believe Chief Martorano, in his appellate brief, characterized that Sergeant Alioto was indifferent, but it's hard to be indifferent in the face of inaction. The appellants have also claimed that Sergeant Alioto was on notice from the time of their answers as to the claimed insufficiency of his claims, but these were boilerplate affirmative defenses. There was not any detail contained. These were the same affirmative defenses that I would expect any competent and reasonable litigator to assert in such a case. It certainly is not a notice to the plaintiff that defendants believed that he should amend his complaint. Secondly, the motion to dismiss, stopping on the sufficiency of the amended complaint, first of all, I think we've established good cause in that that the motion for leave to amend should have been granted in the interest of justice. After that, the court, Judge Stattmuller, I think, abused his discretion in determining that the amended complaint was insufficient and did not state claims. I believe that for the same reasons that the motions to dismiss were ultimately granted incorrectly, Judge Stattmuller made several findings of fact and in determining that the amended complaint would be futile, and findings of fact are inappropriate on a motion to dismiss. The pleading is the basis for the motion, and there should be no look beyond those pleadings. Judge Stattmuller declared that the qualified immunity defense was appropriate. But again, I would revert to where you have a plain statement giving facts which form the basis for a claim, that is sufficient. And the Ashcroft case, in which the defendants have relied, simply applies a new catchphrase to a very tried and true concept, which is facial plausibility. But it's identical to the same standard that's found in the Bell Atlantic case, which is that you simply have to have enough facts to raise a reasonable expectation that discovery will reveal evidence of the claim asserted. I would argue that the amended complaint, as well as the original complaint, contains those facts that put the defendants on notice as to the basis for the claims, and certainly points to the reasonable expectation that during discovery the claims will be illuminated in a way that the defendants can defend against. Certainly, again, pulling that into the argument on the motions to dismiss, Judge Stattmuller did make several inappropriate findings of fact, namely that he concludes that because it's not pled in the complaint that that Sergeant Alioto did not ask for a hearing pursuant to the statutes, Chapter 62 of the Wisconsin statutes, that he did not do so. And again, the standard is that all inferences, reasonable inferences and assumptions based on the facts in the complaint are to be given to the plaintiff. Basically, the plaintiff is to be given the benefit of the doubt. Judge Stattmuller did exactly the opposite here. He assumed the worst.
Is there anything in the amended complaint that was not available to Officer Aliotta prior to the scheduling deadline?
I can't speak to that personally, given that I wasn't counsel for Mr. Alioto during the district court. But, I mean, certainly the extent, as was pled in the original complaint, there was open records requests which were not not complied with by the town. When we received this case, it was boxes of materials, which I'm not sure when, you know, what was available at the time that the original complaint was filed and what was obtained afterwards. I see that my time is up. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Ms. Reyes. Mr. Wistrom.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Oyvind Wistrom. I represent the defendant, Terry Martorano, the former police chief of the town of Lisbon in this matter.
How big is Lisbon?
How big is what?
Lisbon.
Lisbon is a small rural community outside of Milwaukee, about 35 minutes northwest. Population, I don't know exactly, but I would estimate it under 10,000.
Under 10,000.
We know, in retrospect, not large enough to have a police department.
In retrospect, we have learned that. They subsequently decided to contract out their police services to the Waukesha County Sheriff's Department. But the actions giving rise to this lawsuit occurred prior to that decision, which happened at the end of 2007. For purposes of our arguments this morning, in that there are three different named defendants, two different attorneys. I represent Terry Martorano. Dan Borowski represents the town, and Jeffrey Mouchet, the town administrator. I will be focusing on the original complaint and the defendant's motion to dismiss, while Mr. Borowski will be addressing the amended complaint and the plaintiff's motion to file an amended complaint. First off,
The context of a motion to dismiss rather than summary judgment, shouldn't it be enough that the complaint asserts facts indicating that he was forced from his job in retaliation for his speech regarding political corruption, and that he wasn't, provided any kind of a hearing?
Certainly the original complaint did not contain those types of allegations. It makes reference to the fact that he himself, by virtue of his doctor's opinion, went on a medical leave of absence in the end of 2006, and he remained on a leave of absence. At the time that he was released by his doctor indicated he can return to work, but only in a work environment that wasn't hostile.
So would your argument be any different if he had quit his job when the harassment escalated instead of taking medical leave? I mean, would that constructive discharge have given rise to a valid constitutional claim, do you think?
Potentially, if the constructive discharge was caused by conduct that was so abusive that he had no reasonable alternative but to quit. But in order to establish a hostile work environment based on the First Amendment, you also first need to establish that you had or engaged in protected First Amendment speech.
Right.
There's no indication in this complaint, either in the original or the amended complaint, that he engaged in protected First Amendment speech. Certainly, with respect to his communications to the board regarding potential misconduct by Terry Martorano, his communications to the town board bringing that to their attention, I don't think it would ever get past the Garcetti versus Caballos defense based on the Supreme Court. With respect to the motion to dismiss, I think it's important, first of all, to notice that at no point in time at the district court level does Mr. Alioto respond to defendant's motion to dismiss. The law is very clear that a party that fails to respond to a motion or an argument at the district court level precludes and is waived from doing so at the Court of Appeals. And there's absolutely no arguments made by the plaintiffs in this lawsuit concerning the merits of the motion to dismiss. Rather than responding to that motion, they elected to file a motion for an amended or motion for leave to file an amended complaint. But by virtue of failing to respond to the merits of defendant's argument on the motion to dismiss, they have now waived their opportunity to do so. So any arguments concerning the correctness of the district court's opinion to dismiss the original complaint cannot be argued before this court. Additionally, if the court is inclined to address and look at the merits of the underlying complaint, as counsel for plaintiff indicated, the standard is under Rule 8 of the civil rules. But what the law also requires is that additional or sufficient facts be pled to establish a case that's plausible on its face. And in reviewing this complaint, which I've reviewed numerous times, it simply does not provide sufficient facts for a reasonable defendant to determine the nature of the claims being asserted. For instance, under Section 1983, the law is very clear that a plaintiff is required to plead a statutory or constitutional basis for their action. There's nothing in the complaint that establishes the statutory or constitutional basis for the 1983 action. The only reference is to 1983 itself, and we know that 1983 itself is not a substantive or is not itself a substantive constitutional right. It only serves as a vehicle for other constitutional or statutory deprivations to be brought. So plaintiff's reference to 1983 in and of itself is not sufficient to put or to establish a constitutional or statutory deprivation. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Wistrom. Mr. Borowski.
Good morning. May it please the Court. My name is Daniel Borowski. I'm appearing on behalf of the Town of Lisbon and Jeffrey Mouche. The issue I'll be handling is whether the district court used its discretion in denying the motion to amend in this case.
You don't identify your client by which county it's in. There are two towns of Lisbon in Wisconsin. I assume you're the Waukesha Lisbon?
I'm assuming as well, yes.
Wisconsin ought to have a rule that towns and cities, right, there can only be one of them per state.
I think there's more than one in even other
two
cities.
Two Lisbons in Wisconsin.
The standard...
And one in Portugal.
The standard for the district court's decision is whether a district court abused its discretion. And the determination or district court's denial of a motion to amend will be denied only if a reasonable person could not agree with the decision. And here the district court's decision was reasonable, rational, and based on existing law. Rather than belabor the points that I've set forth in the brief, I just want to highlight a couple of things that I've heard here today. Initially, the burden was on the plaintiff in this case to correct any deficiencies in their complaint. There's nothing under the good cause standard requires reasonable diligence by the plaintiff, not the defendants. The defendants are under no obligation to put the plaintiff on notice. But in this case, they did. And if we follow the time frame, and I will quickly do it, on September of 2008, the defendants had answers and affirmative defenses, which brought up failure to state a claim and brought up the various immunity issues. More importantly, the plaintiff claims, I think I'm hearing today, that they were not aware that was not sufficient to put them on notice that the complaint was in, that they were failing to state a claim. Well, in the Rule 26F discovery report, which is in the record at Document 18, and which was a joint submission to the court prior to the scheduling order, it plainly states at paragraph A that defendants, quote, defendants deny each of the claims asserted and anticipate filing a motion to dismiss, unquote. That document was filed with the court on October 17th, 2008, which is roughly 10 months prior to the time that the plaintiff finally moved to amend, and 2 months prior to the deadline in the scheduling order. The scheduling order also was based on the Rule 26F report, so the deadlines in that report and the scheduling order came out of that report and the party stipulation. And again, the plaintiff, on notice both in the answer, affirmative defenses, and through the discovery report, stipulated to a deadline of November 30th of 2008 to file amended pleadings. I've heard nothing here today, and there's certainly nothing in any of the briefs that have been filed up to this point which shows that the plaintiff exercised any reasonable diligence. And I think the case law is clear that blaming it on the defendants is not sufficient to establish good cause. And in this case, even if you could try to blame it on the defense plainly put the plaintiff on notice with respect to the deficiencies in the complaint. So for that reason, I think the district court's decision, for that reason alone, that this district court's decision should be affirmed. Rule 16 does not require us to go into the interest of justice, as plaintiff's counsel may have suggested. If there has been no reasonable diligence shown, then that's the end of the inquiry, and I think that's cited in the Johnson case, which this court has approved. But the district court did go further, and under Rule 15A, it looked to whether the amended complaint did state a claim. And again, without going through each of the claims, I think it's clear that the plaintiff, even in the amended complaint, has not alleged facts which are sufficient to establish the deprivation of a constitutional right under any of the grounds or statutory right, whether it be to wages, overtime, freedom of association.
Has he filed a suit in state court?
Excuse me?
Has he filed a suit in state court?
He is, to my knowledge, he is not.
The claim that I wasn't paid for work actually done might be a perfectly good claim in state court. I'm a little surprised to see it here.
Right. The wage claim was brought as a 1983 claim, and initially I'm not sure he certainly hasn't pointed in his amended complaint to any statutory basis that he had a property right to be paid in overtime wages. The sole statutory basis is under Chapter 62, and that allowed him to have some form of content.
It might be a good claim. Presumably it's either a good claim or a bad claim under state law, but the Constitution doesn't require states to follow their own law. That's a pretty well-established principle.
So it hasn't established, to my knowledge, just a quick step back, the only claim that I'm aware of they filed was a work comp claim relative to the underlying emotional distress.
Thank you, Mr. Borowski.
Thank you very much.
The case is taken under advisement.